From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The 2020 census results are starting to roll in. Michigan, it appears, has lost a congressional seat. What will that mean for the state's political landscape?
This is the fifth consecutive census in which we will have lost a congressional seat, at least one.
Also today, the story of a Filipino Michigander who served in the Civil War.
Here is a very slight, 16 to 18-year-old kid from the South Pacific that just shows up in rural Michigan in the 1860s.
And Dr. Abdul El-Sayed talks about why now is not the time to let up on the pandemic.
What we did in the fall, what we did last spring, doesn't really buy us out of the responsibility to lead and to save lives right now.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Tomorrow night, President Biden addresses a joint session of Congress, and in doing so, he's expected to lay out a framework for his administration's next big legislative push. Will it include comprehensive solutions for healthcare problems laid bare by the pandemic?
People in our country are suffering without health care in the middle of a pandemic. People are going without access to hospital care because their hospitals are shutting down. All of these things are problems that the president has the opportunity to solve, and I believe he ought to solve them.
Abdul El-Sayed gives us his thoughts later this hour. But first, we want to get some detail on another matter that's going to be very important for Michigan's immediate future. The U.S. Census data gathered last year is going to be delivered a little later than expected, but the Census Bureau released a first data set yesterday that offers a preview of what we might expect. In Michigan, the takeaway is less representation. Our state's population has grown at a slower rate than other parts of the country. And when Michigan's Independent Redistricting Commission sets to work this year, it means we're going to have one less congressional seat than we do now. John Lindstrom is the former publisher of Gongmore News Service Michigan. He covered state politics for more than 40 years, and he's with us today. Hey, John.
How are you?
I'm all right. Should this news about the population drop and the change in our number of districts, should that come as a surprise to people?
Well, first of all, we didn't lose population as we did according to the 2010 census. We just didn't gain it as fast as states like Florida and Texas. And of course, California, for the first time in its history, is going to lose a seat.
Yeah, 2% growth, which is a slower rate than the rest of the country. Thank you for the correction.
Right. And this is the fifth consecutive census in which we will have lost a congressional seat, at least one. We were, from the 1962 election through the 1980 election, we had 19 members of the U.S. House, 21 electoral votes, And now we're going to be down to 15 electoral votes with the two members of the U.S. Senate. And it's quite a striking change in terms of the state's overall strength, and not just Michigan, but the Midwest's overall strength. Midwest grew slower than any other region in the country. This, of course, is the region that at one time was the West. You go back far enough, and of course,
right,
it was the industrial powerhouse of the nation. And now a lot of the industry has moved south, moved west. Part of that is to avoid unions, and part of it is for, ever since the invention of air conditioning, people have moved to places that they otherwise considered inhospitable. But it is astonishing. I mean, if someone wants to look at a good indicator of how different it is, if you pick up a novel that came out in the 1950s called Advise and Consent, it won the Pulitzer Prize. It's about the U.S. Senate. But Michigan was featured in this novel as the powerhouse of the country. The Senate Majority Leader was from Michigan. The Vice President was from Michigan. And of course, you think of all the powerhouse members of Congress that Michigan had. Of course, John Dingell and Bill Ford at one time. John Conyers, long serving legislators. Now the longest serving legislator seems almost like a kid, Fred Upton. He was elected in the mid 80s. It's interesting because you have theoretically nobody who could decide to retire and say, okay, I've had enough. I mean, all of our members of Congress are relatively recent in congressional life. And so no one's going to probably step away and make it easy for the Redistricting Commission to try to figure out a way of avoiding trying to force a runoff between two incumbents.
Right. And we have some people who are very new to congressional office, including Peter Meyer, Republican, also Democrats Haley Stevens and Alyssa Slotkin. Now, the early numbers suggest to us that the areas of depressed growth include all the congressional districts except District 12, Debbie Dingell's. But my read on the early data is that the areas that had the most depressed growth, so to speak, included Brenda Lawrence's district, Haley Stevens' district, number 13, Dan Kildee and Andy Levin's. Is there anything that you can foresee about how the Independent Redistricting Commission might try to square this within the general rules that are before them?
Well, you deal with the reality that one person is not going to be going to Congress. It would be interesting, even more interesting than we had originally thought, because if the redistricting process had gone on as it has for the last 40 or so years, it's pretty clear what would have happened. You have a legislature who is under Republican control. They would have obviously drawn a map that axed out a Democrat. The governor would have vetoed that plan. You would have had a fight. It might have gone to the Supreme Court. I'm not sure what's going to happen this time. A lot of the actual mechanics of how these districts are going to be drawn are not yet resolved. And one of the things that the commissioners on the district, on the redistricting commission, have been doing is just learning some of those basic mechanics. If you follow the meetings, to the average person, they may seem rather dry, but you're just getting into, okay, let's open the hood. Let's start going through. Here's the water pump. Here's the fuel pump. Here's the carburetor. How is this all going to come together? And that is what they're going to have to figure out. There are a variety of ways that you can process these things. And then you have to deal, of course, with the factors of communities of interest, compactness, trying to make sure that you don't break too many lines as you go through this. It's going to be an even bigger challenge now that we are losing one member. The math all suggests that the Detroit area is probably going to lose a representative. It's possible that you could see a situation where, say, Dan Kildee and the newly elected Republican in the Thumb area find themselves tossed together, something like that. But it's until they start processing the actual numbers, until we actually see what the census tracts show, and that won't come for some number of months yet, we really won't know how this can be resolved.
The thought of Dan Kildee and Democrat Dan Kildee and Republican Lisa McClain having to go head to head just makes my head spin.
Well, it makes your head spin. What do you think it'll make their heads do? But I mean, that could remain a possibility. Instead of saying forcing somebody into a primary runoff, you could take two incumbents and force them to do the same thing in a general election. That's not out of the realm of possibility. This is what you run into in a situation like this. It's always a tricky situation. And even when we had 19 representatives, you ran into this occasionally. In the Oakland County area, after the 1970 census, you found two Republican incumbents forced together and ended up running against each other in a primary, even though the state didn't lose any representatives at that time. This is just the luck of the draw. And of course, this is mandated by legislation passed by Congress. We have not had any increase in the total number of members of the U.S. House for 170 something years. That's not stipulated in the Constitution. That too is also by congressional statute. So in theory, although I don't know how popular it would be with the general public, in theory, you could turn around and say, hey, wait a minute, the House needs to add a few members, not lose them. Here's the thing. If you want to use the analogy of a car again, all you know is that you're going to have something that's going to go down the road. You don't know if it's going to be four wheels, three wheels. You don't know if it's going to be electric or gas. You don't know if it's going to be steam powered for all that. You don't know if you're going to have it drive on the left, drive in the middle, drive in the right. All you know is you're going to have something that's going down the road. And that's what we're facing with now. The members of the Congressional Redistricting Commission, or the state's Redistricting Commission, have been handed, this is your assignment. However you do it, do it, as long as it meets these requirements. And those requirements are, as we said, compactness, lines, you know, equality of districts, and considering communities of interest.
John, does the commission have to start with the existing congressional map, or would it be possible for it to go back to square one and draw everything as if this were Michigan year zero?
It does not have to use the existing map. And in fact, it probably won't. There is one consideration that you have to keep in mind. In effect, the Detroit area has to have two Black representatives come out of it. So how do you draw those lines? How do you set that up? It almost invites a situation like, would you have, for example, Brenda Lawrence going up against Rashida Tlaib? Or would you put Rashida Tlaib against Debbie Dingell? So that you avoid the possibility of a Black representative losing. I don't know. I mean, that's one of the few constraints that they have to keep in mind. But otherwise, you know, I think you have to go wide open on this now for the getting anything done that makes any kind of sense. I don't know that you keep to the existing map. You have to assume that people are going to still be representing the same basic areas. I mean, you know, it's unlikely that Fred Upton's going to be representing Marquette, for example. But, you know, who knows? In the end, you could be extraordinarily creative as long as you meet the requirements that prohibit gerrymandering, which is what the voters wanted to stop. And that becomes the next question. Once you come up with the lines, I mean, everyone says, oh, this will favor the Republicans or this will favor the Democrats. You have no idea. You have no idea what will happen in the next election. Where will the votes actually come from? Who will actually be affected? It's a wide open situation right now.
John Lindstrom is the former publisher of Gong War News Service Michigan. John, thank you so much.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for asking.
Coming up after a quick break, the life of one Union soldier who came to Michigan from across an ocean.
There wasn't a Panama Canal. He'd go all the way down around the southern tip of South America, all the way from the Philippines, comes to New York, goes to Michigan.
That's in just a minute. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. 160 years ago this month, the fever of war gripped Michigan. What most thought would be a quick war between the North and the South was anything but. 4 years later, nearly 15,000 Michiganders had died in the effort to restore the Union and end slavery. Today, we're going to focus on one Michigan volunteer, Felix Balderi, who came to the Great Lakes from the other side of the world, the Philippines. Joining us now with the details of Felix Balderi's amazing journey is State Archivist for the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Hi, Mark. Welcome back.
Hi, April. Thanks.
Hey, can we set the stage a little bit? The 19th century was a pretty consequential period for the Philippines and its relationship to what we refer to as the Western powers. What was going on in Felix Balderi's part of the world around 1860? It seems like this was just a crazy period for global trade.
It really is. It's fascinating because we think of the Philippines in American history when we engage with them right at the turn of the 19th and 20th century. But America became this burgeoning whaling power going back all the way to the 1790s and really built that up in the first part of the 19th century. And so we're over in the South Pacific having interactions, and so are a lot of other powers, Russia and the Dutch. Everybody's over there. And you can look at these time-lapse maps of trade routes, and it's just this well-worn path all over that area. And Japan was doing their best to be isolationist. And as early as the 1840s and 50s, America and Russia were sort of putting the elbow to them. And the Philippines seems like they always get caught in the middle because of their strategic position.
Right. It was before the Philippine Revolution, but suffice to say, there was just a lot going on in the Philippines. What do we know then about Felix Balderi's early life?
We don't know a lot other than he grew up on this small northern island of Bataan. And at about age 16, as these U.S. whaling ships would come into harbor, and as they had been for 50 plus years, that just always strikes me that, you know, you think of late 1850s, how could we get ships from Nantucket, Massachusetts, all the way to Bataan Island, Philippines? But we'd been doing it for a long time. And I guess he decided he wanted to change a pace and stowed away on the whaling ship, the Milton. And that really starts the beginning of his adventure.
As you say, the whaling business was one way to travel halfway around the world in the 1800s. Do you have much of a sense of whether that was common, whether people would just sort of disappear themselves onto ships and find themselves in a completely new universe?
We don't have a lot of evidence of that in this particular story, other than we can look at the facts. Here is a 16-year-old boy on a remote island. So his story could be replicated pretty much anywhere in the world, right? 16-year-old, restless kid, small town, nothing going on, wants to get out and see the world. Oh, here's a whaling ship on my doorstep. It seemed like the ripe opportunity, even though I'm sure he had no idea what he was getting into.
After Felix got to the East Coast via whaling ship, how did he come to make Michigan his home?
So when he was on the ship, he was a stowaway, and he was befriended by the first mate, a guy named Joseph Foster. And they made it back eventually, around 1860, made it back to Massachusetts. Foster lived in Southampton, New York. And the year after they returned to the U.S., Foster moved his family to Leonidas, Michigan. Again, we don't know exactly why, but this is the time when a lot of people are migrating from New York because land is cheap. And at least in some parts of Michigan, the soil is pretty good. And I would say the soil in that part of the state is pretty good, still is. And so they moved to Michigan in the early 1860s to set up shops, farmers. And he just went along with them and served as a farmhand.
And for those who aren't exactly sure where Leonidas, or what we would say today, Leonidas Township, can be found, this is just a little bit south of Battle Creek, right?
Yeah, I would say maybe more slightly southeast. If you look at a map of Kalamazoo and just sort of draw a very slight line southeast, it's along M60, which if you ever get a chance to go for a drive in the country, drive down M60. It's a great drive.
Mark, whaling ships were very often a mix of people from a lot of different backgrounds. To some extent, we can say that about the old Northwest, what we now call Michigan. What do we know about how Felix's Caucasian neighbors reacted to him, whether he was accepted as part of the community when he arrived?
I have to think he was. As surprising as that might seem in our current climate, here is a very slight, you know, 16 to 18-year-old kid from the South Pacific that just shows up in rural Michigan in the 1860s. And I make that assumption because in 1863, he joined with all his community members in the local infantry unit to serve in the Civil War. I don't think you can do that if you're an outcast.
Right. What was Felix Baldieri's military career like?
Well, he signed up with the 11th Michigan Infantry, which Civil War units were really comprised of communities. So you would go into a unit with the people you lived with. And a lot of times in the Civil War, that was friends and family. And the 11th Infantry served in the Atlanta Campaign. So he basically shipped out and went into the fairly deep south right away, down into Georgia, and was part of that Atlanta Campaign. And really saw a lot of action, a lot of marching. And as was the case with a lot of Civil War soldiers, had a rough time, not as much in the battles, but in the environment and battling sickness and disease.
Well, we know that illness took a lot of soldiers during the Civil War. What kind of illnesses was he dealing with?
Yeah, when you read his pension file, the medical portions of it, I mean, they're not really medical records, but they mention his ailments. And I don't know if it's sad or ironic or both that what afflicted this person from the South Pacific was sort of the marshy, humid conditions. And I think what really exacerbated it was those big changes in swings in temperature and weather mixed with the moisture, because he just developed some respiratory issues that plagued him for the rest of his life.
Do we know what it was? Was it tuberculosis or malaria?
He was finally diagnosed with tuberculosis, and that was listed as his cause of death much later in life.
A man comes halfway around the planet from the Philippines and ends up with what we think of as a tropical disease.
Right. I guess that's what keeps sticking in my mind is he makes his journey. I mean, there wasn't a Panama Canal. They go all the way down around the southern tip of South America, all the way from the Philippines, comes to New York, goes to Michigan, serves in the Civil War, down into Georgia, and then is cast the lot of contracting tuberculosis. It's quite incredible.
For some people, military service is what makes them and changes their lives in positive ways. But Felix Baldery was part of a generation of people whose lives were really shattered by the Civil War. What sense do you have of how the war years set the course for the rest of his life?
He returned a broken man. In fact, one of the lieutenants from his unit, which would have been a person from his community, described him as an ideal soldier going in. Strong, loyal, really reliable soldier, and afterwards described him as a broken down man. That's a direct quote from his pension application.
There were certain long haul effects of the diseases that he had.
Yeah, he suffered some partial paralysis in his left arm, which, you know, if you're a farmhand, that's not going to work. And he was unable to perform that essential task that he had for his mentor and, I don't want to call him patron, but basically his connection, Joseph Foster. He wasn't able to do that manual labor. And so he opened a tailor shop on the edge of Foster's property in Leonidas and did that for a time, and then actually found employment as a tailor in the town of Cologne and lived out the rest of his life in that area. But going back to your question about how he was received in the community, I think it's really interesting that, you know, the Grand Army of the Republic was the veterans organization. He was a member of the local post there and attended the Methodist Episcopal Church there. So he was a bona fide part of the community.
Did he ever marry?
He did later in life. He was in his early 40s. He married a 16-year-old named Ada Mae Barnes, and they had one son from that marriage named Frank.
Does the historical record give us any indications of how he felt about his military service or his life in Michigan?
Unfortunately, it doesn't really speak to that, and we don't have, as we do with other Civil War veterans, letters or diaries where they really expound on what they think about the war and their service and how it's affected their life back in their community. We don't have that for him. We just have this literal portrait, a couple different portraits of Felix, and then we have the portrait we've pieced together from his pension record, from the ship's log of the Milton, and just some background history that we've looked at from whaling in the South Pacific. So I wish we had a firsthand account. I like to think that he felt he was doing his duty for his adopted country, that he was treated right, and that spurned him on to service. I don't know that we can ever truly know, but I think that given his track record with how he conducted his post-war life and remained part of the community that he came to, I think it's very possible.
How did you find out about Felix Baldery?
Well, so in the archives, sometimes when you're looking for one thing, you find another. That happens a lot. And I actually encourage staff to always keep an eye out for those sorts of things. And I was aware that we had a couple different photographs of him, but we went to do our biannual magazine and we did it on the Civil War. And we really were looking at articles of basically Michigan's diverse contribution to the Civil War, whether it was the Company K, which was mostly Native Americans, or the 1st Michigan Colored Infantry, basically people that were signing up that maybe weren't really represented in the first place. And we stumbled across this image, and I really have to give credit to our archivist, Leslie Edwards, because when she gets a colonel like this, she just cannot let it go. And so she stumbled across the image, told me about it, and I said, yeah, I'm aware of that. But then she took it from there and found his pension application and contacted the Whaling Museum on the East Coast and found the ship's log and just went from one resource to another. So it was a really great piece of research on her part.
Mark Harvey is state archivist at the Michigan History Center. Mark, thank you so much for sharing Felix's story with us.
Thank you.
There are some places in Michigan where if you want to put a solar panel on your roof, you might not be able to. That's thanks to a state law that limits how many homes and businesses can connect to the grid with solar panels.
I have had customers, you know, approach me and we have to turn them away because we know that that cap's been reached and that the utility is not going to interconnect them.
A new bill in the state House of Representatives would change this, and it has support from both sides of the aisle. However, it is facing fierce opposition from utility companies. Interlaken Public Radio's Lexi Krupp has more on the battle over rooftop solar in Michigan.
Despite the pandemic, it's been a good year for small-scale solar developers in the state.
Things are good, and we have a good crew and, you know, good people.
Alan O'Shea is the president of CBS Solar. It's based in a small town in Manistee County and one of the underwriters of the station. Alan has been in the business for 40 years and seen it through a lot of ups and downs.
We used to have to travel all the way to Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio because that's how diffuse the customers were way back when. And now we can pretty much expand right on the west side of the state.
Batteries are more efficient, the price of solar panels has plummeted, and solar customers are no longer just the liberal crowd concerned about their carbon footprint.
We can sell it to essentially both sides of the aisle, if you know what I mean.
Ian Olmsted is the founder and president of Peninsula Solar, based in Marquette and Leelanau County.
Basically, it comes down to price. I mean, you can be sending your kid to college for what you're paying electric rates in the UP for.
For Ian, though, despite all the potential for residential solar in Michigan, there's a huge cloud hanging over this industry. He says state policy is crippling expansion, especially in the UP.
Michigan should be a boom town, a boom state for solar. And we're not seeing it. We're lagging behind. You know, we get a D plus. We get a D minus for our policy.
According to state law, there's a cap on how many people can install rooftop solar and hook up to the electric grid, meaning they can share excess electricity with their neighbors and buy energy on dark winter days. And when you look around at other states, Michigan's limit on rooftop solar is one of the most restrictive in the country.
There's 40 other states with caps that are greater than 5%, and we're at 1%. So it's just incredible. I mean, Vermont, for example, is 15%.
Ben Schimpf also works at Peninsula Solar, and a lot of installers like Ben and Ian are hoping lawmakers will step in here to allow more rooftop solar projects. Right now, there's proposed legislation that would eliminate the cap on rooftop solar entirely. It was introduced by Representative Greg Markkinen, a Republican from the Western UP, where electricity rates are some of the highest in the state. It has support from both parties in the House, but some fear more rooftop solar would mean higher prices for everyone else. Utility companies in particular have raised this concern. A representative from DTE Energy told IPR the company does not, quote, support our customers paying higher rates to subsidize those who invest in their own system. Tony Anderson is the general manager at Cherryland Electric Cooperative, a non-for-profit that serves a chunk of Northwest Michigan. He says down the road, if way more people put solar on their homes and buy significantly less electricity from their utility, those companies would have to recover costs to maintain the grid.
If you're going to have a bunch of solar on your house and only use my electricity when the sun goes down or when you have a problem with your system, there has to be a fee for that, and there has to be a fair fee for that. So everybody else who doesn't have solar panels isn't subsidizing your choice. And that's easily done. We just change the availability charge.
Right now, though, there's just not enough residential solar for this to be a problem. And clean energy advocates say there's already a policy in place to ensure solar customers pay their fair share. They actually sell the electricity they generate back to the grid for a fraction of the normal rate. Despite all this, Tony says he's not surprised big utility companies oppose the move to expand rooftop solar.
They're just trying to take care of their business. They're in the business of selling electricity, and this prevents that. So, of course, they would not like it.
And a lot of these companies hold significant political sway in Michigan. Utilities like DTE and Consumers have contributed millions of dollars to political lobbying groups in the state and have spent tens of thousands of dollars on individual political campaigns to unseat industry critics. Legislators like Representative John Roth from Traverse City say they have to work with utilities if they want to pass legislation. In this case, he thinks there's some middle ground.
Uncapping it entirely may not happen. I'm pretty sure the electric companies are going to fight back on that.
He says more likely lawmakers will negotiate to raise the cap, maybe to 5% or so. Ian Olmsted, the president of Peninsula Solar, thinks regardless of what happens with this legislation, rooftop solar is here to stay.
It's coming down the line. The technology, the battery prices are lowering every single day. And people are going to be cutting the cords completely soon.
These days, a good part of his business is installing solar panels and battery systems so homes can be completely off the grid. There's nothing lawmakers or utility companies can do about that. For Stateside, I'm Lexi Krupp.
Even during the pandemic, people are losing their health insurance. Is there a solution?
Medicare for All is an approach that would finally get us to that level where nobody would have to worry about how they would pay for healthcare.
In a moment, Dr. Abdul El-Sayed makes his case for universal healthcare in a new book. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're entering another week with Michigan leading the nation on a third surge of COVID cases and hospitalizations. Though there have been some positive signals that the current surge is beginning to ebb, it's still dire in some hospitals where patients have been much younger than during the first and second surges. At the same time, Michigan vaccinations continue at a good and steady pace in the state, but there are signs that the demand for vaccination is also ebbing, perhaps early. We've been talking with elected officials and public health experts throughout the pandemic, and we're joined today by the former health director of the city of Detroit, Abdul El-Sayed, MD. He's also a policymaker in residence now at the Gerald Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Abdul El-Sayed, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me, April.
A lot of people have trouble reconciling two facts right now. Michigan has done a great many preventative things throughout late last year in the winter. Folks stayed distance, kept masked. And we also had a bit of an edge on some other states in the U.S. in terms of vaccine access. At the same time, our case rates are crazy high right now compared with, say, Florida or even most of Texas. How is it both things are true?
Yeah, unfortunately, SARS-CoV-2, the virus behind COVID-19, has a very short memory. And though the incredible measures that we took, whether it was last spring or this fall, saved lives, and there's good evidence to demonstrate that, the hard part about this moment with the pandemic fatigue we have and the over-optimism that I think people have about the fact that we have vaccines versus the number of actual vaccinations that have been delivered and the aggressive reopening have left the window open for a new variant, the B.1.1.7 UK variant, to run amok. We are in a situation now where, thankfully, cases look like they've declined now for about a week, and hospitalizations have started to decline too. But we're still at an extremely high rate. I talked to my clinical colleagues, and they're telling me that their beds are filled with people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. This is a moment where we still have to remember that this is a real risk in front of us.
Governor Gretchen Whitmer gained some popularity early in the pandemic for her regulatory clampdown on the state, which helped to curb Michigan's infection rate faster than most other places in the nation. So now, during this third surge, the early popularity that she enjoyed might be waning. Can I ask what you make of the governor's handling of this stage of the pandemic and the decision not to exercise state authority, either herself or the State Department of Health and Human Services again?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I was so incredibly proud of our state and proud of the governor in the spring and the fall, acting in the face of some really profound political backlash. But what we did in the fall, what we did last spring, doesn't really buy us out of the responsibility to lead and to save lives right now. And so it is frustrating to have watched the relative non-response in the face of what has been, by many metrics, the worst surge that we've faced of COVID-19, and especially in the context of the incredible leadership that she showed in the first place. And so I do think that, you know, this is a moment where the optimism about the vaccines, coupled with the fatigue that a lot of people are facing, tends to dial up the political cost of action. And yet, what we expect, what we demand of our leaders is that they act even in challenging circumstances, even in the face of backlash from folks who have been wrong about this pandemic from the beginning. And the worrying thing, right, is that, you know, you watch the governor get plaudits from leaders on the other side of the aisle, but these are the same leaders who have been denying the pandemic in the first place. And so we know that this pandemic that's taken 572,000 American lives now is real. And you talk to any of the families who've lost loved ones, and they'll tell you that their loss and their grief is real. And we have a responsibility, I think, to continue to fight it until the pandemic is behind us.
The state has three big problems right now in terms of vaccination. There are some people who are hesitant to schedule because they feel this is a vaccine that's very new. They're not 100% sure that they're ready to trust in the vaccine just yet. Others have declined vaccination because they think the pandemic is overblown. It may be a political matter for them. And there are some folks who might want to be vaccinated, but who are having trouble navigating the system that we have to offer vaccines. Maybe they work multiple jobs. Maybe they don't have the computer access that they need. Or maybe there are language barriers. I wonder, do you think the state has to choose which of those three to tackle head on, or is there some way to make headway with all three groups at once?
You know, I think we don't have a choice but to try and make headway with all three groups at once, simply because we know that in order to get this pandemic behind us, in order to allow the vaccines to do what they can at the population level, we have to achieve what we call herd immunity. And to get there, the consensus among epidemiologists is that we need 70 to 80% of people having been vaccinated. We've been watching over the last 2 weeks as the number of new vaccinations is declining day by day. Vaccine hesitancy really is the challenge here. But I think rather than thinking about vaccine hesitancy per se, maybe it might be helpful for us to be thinking about vaccine willingness. To get a vaccination done, to achieve a vaccination event in someone who may be less vaccine willing, what has to happen is there has to be a larger, broader conversation about the value and importance of these vaccines, coupled with a message carried by people that person knows and trusts that all intersect with a moment of availability of that vaccine. And I think part of the hard part with what we're doing right now is that we are trying to get all of these pieces right on their own terms, but thinking a little bit less about how you make them match up in one person. To give an example, we know that in the city of Detroit, where I used to be the health director, vaccine access is limited, as is vaccine willingness. But there's a way where we think about trying to optimize how those things come together in one time. So, you know, we've had in the city for some time now, people knocking doors, going door to door to talk about the vaccine and talk to folks in neighborhoods. That's great. Those folks should have a vaccine on hand, because if you can have that conversation with someone and say, listen, we've got a vaccine right here for you. What this would do for you, your loved ones, your family, friends and family members, your access to all the things that you're missing out in your life, it would change everything. And we need you to get that vaccine. And having that vaccine accessible in that moment is critical, because if then that person says, you know what, I might think about getting a vaccine, but that means that they have to go online and they may not have internet access to make an appointment at some place that's going to be open next week, where they'd have to take time off of work and figure out their transportation. There are so many hurdles in the way of achieving that vaccination, even if that person has gotten to that point where they're in fact willing. And so I think that's where we need to be headed, because otherwise I worry that the way we've been going is not going to get us to herd immunity. And every day that this disease continues to spread is a new day when it could evolve a variant that could slip our vaccine-mediated immunity.
If you're just joining us today, my guest is Dr. Abdul El-Sayed. He's policymaker in residence at the Gerald Ford School of Public Policy, former health director for the city of Detroit. He's also co-author with Dr. Micah Johnson of the new book, Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide. Abdul, I offer this next question with the understanding that both of us here on either end of the interview are both employees of the University of Michigan. But we just learned that the U of M intends to require students living on campus to get a vaccine next fall. Of course, your main field is medicine, but you also have your head in the policy sphere. Do you think institutions should be worried about legal challenges if in the coming months they decide to mandate vaccines?
You know, I think the legal challenges are going to come on either side of this. And it puts institutions like the university in a really challenging position. And I think if you know you're liable to face lawsuits on either side of a challenge, the bigger question you ought to be asking is what's the right thing to do? And I think the university is making a good decision. A lot of folks will argue, well, mandating vaccines to get access to things like room and board at the university is a form of discrimination. And I just don't buy that argument, right? That'd be like saying that speed limits are discriminating against people who enjoy speeding. And I think that the point here is not about whether or not this is a matter of discrimination. It's about whether or not we as a society are willing to engage with the reality of this pandemic and do things that need to protect people. Because on the other side of not mandating these vaccines for folks living in university housing is the risk that people are getting sick from what we know to be a preventable disease if people are willing to wear masks and get vaccinated. And unless we want to hem in our institutions around folks who are making decisions that are not based in science, then the university, I think, has a responsibility to protect its students. And so while they're going to face, I think, some legal challenges on this front, let's not forget that the other side of this would leave thousands of students at risk. I think the university is siding with their responsibility to protect their student body and the folks who live and work on campus.
I think the past few weeks have really challenged some people's ideas about what it's ever going to mean to get back to normal, when our workplaces are going to welcome us back in if we have not been working in person, when our restaurants and other businesses can operate at an increased capacity. How do you look at the balance of ensuring that a novel virus does not decimate our population, does not decimate families, with the long-term need to have our financial and economic houses in order and regain some of the wealth that's been lost?
If you look at the countries that have done this well, places like New Zealand and Australia, the things that they did well at the very beginning are what are allowing them to have, you know, 50,000 person concerts now, universally open, 100% capacity restaurants, etc. They took the virus seriously. They listened to the best evidence that was available, and they were able, probably most importantly, to invest in protecting their population from the economic consequences of what was necessary to protect their population from the virus in the first place. And the challenge with what we've had in the United States is that we've had a piecemeal approach to thinking about policies like lockdowns and even masks, and late and minimal economic support for the population that was being asked to undergo what were some pretty profound economic and social disturbances in the face of trying to protect people from the virus. And the hard part with it, right, is that so many of the inequities that we see in the consequences of COVID-19 are a function of the fact that even while we had lockdowns and shutdowns, we asked certain groups of people to go right into the pandemic and keep working, deeming them essential, even though we had not yet reached any consensus, still haven't, about whether or not we should even pay them a living wage for the work that they do every day. You know, what's happening is that this pandemic is demonstrating some of the profound inconsistencies in the way that we are asking people to take this thing on and asking them to sacrifice, and also the profound inconsistencies that have existed in those same questions even before the pandemic ever hit us. And so I do think you have to balance those things, but the answer isn't, protect people from the virus or not. The answer is protect people from the virus and also protect them from the economic consequences of what it will take to protect them from the virus.
The new book that you co-authored is on the subject of Medicare for All, very timely as we're witnessing some differences of opinion among Democrats in Washington, D.C. about what the Biden administration should go for in its next big aid package, the American Family Plan. Should it be prescription coverage for everyone or a bigger structural reform to get most of America covered? When senators talk about Medicaid or Medicare expansions, are they talking about Medicare for All as you envision it?
The way that we define Medicare for All in the book is a single-payer universal national health insurance plan that would cover everyone, leave nobody out, and protect people from a lot of the pernicious, predatory practices of the health insurance industry as they exist right now. Most of the plans on the table that are being discussed now, they would expand Medicaid or expand Medicare, but they don't go quite as far. And the important difference is that I think we've been, in some parts, having the wrong debate, the wrong conversation about what it means to provide people healthcare in our country, because we're so focused on this question of coverage. And the problem is that not all coverage is created equal. For folks on Medicaid, they'll tell you that not many doctors in their local communities will take their Medicaid. And even though we ought to expand it and ought to improve the benefits, we will not really have achieved the kind of outcome that we really want until everybody has really high quality coverage. I do believe, though, that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. I think, ultimately, the president has demonstrated that he is not supportive of Medicare for All, but it does not then preclude opportunities to expand public health insurance. I had the opportunity to serve on the Unity Task Force that drafted the platform on which he ultimately ran. And we were able to devise a broad-shouldered, muscular public option that was heavily subsidized, 100% subsidies for people earning less than 200% of poverty, which is $52,000 a year, that would hold prescription drug companies accountable by allowing Medicare to negotiate on their behalf, that would expand Medicare and bring the age downward. So these are all really good things, even though I would still argue that they're not enough, that we can still do better. And if we followed the demonstrable outcomes of almost any other high-income country in the world, it suggests that Medicare for All is an approach that would finally get us to that level where nobody would have to worry about how they would pay for healthcare or worry about whether or not their healthcare, even if insured, would send them into bankruptcy.
What's the case for doing this now while the country is still in crisis, while the country is spending a ton of money on aid to people who've had losses during the pandemic, and also with midterms on the horizon, at which point it's likely that Republicans will try to turn health coverage into a political football?
Well, April, we talked about this, right? What's the point of holding an office of leadership in this country if you're unwilling to lead on the issues that people are suffering from? And one of the consequences that we saw from this pandemic was how quickly our healthcare system was laid out by this pandemic. We watched as 15 million Americans lost their health insurance coverage in the midst of the worst pandemic in over 100 years. Ours is the only healthcare system in the world where people were kicked off of their health insurance while they were facing a pandemic. But not only that, we watched our brave nurses and doctors and hospital workers caring for the sick and dying, wearing garbage bags because for-profit incentives in the healthcare system mean that you don't stockpile things that you might need in a pandemic. We watched as our country went without the ventilators that so many people needed to be able to breathe in the beginning of the pandemic, largely because the company that the U.S. Had negotiated a contract with to produce those ventilators simply decided that it just wasn't worth their time to produce this. The profit margin was too low. And the irony of it is that the company was called Covidian. You can't even make it up. We watched as our hospitals continue to fill up in communities all over the country. And they are fighting bankruptcy at the same time as they're fighting COVID-19 because the circumstances forcing them to cancel their most lucrative elective procedures. We saw 47 hospitals go bankrupt or shut down in 2020 alone. And they're disproportionately likely to be rural hospitals where people are now left having to drive 2 or 3 hours. And so, you know, if President Biden is serious about solving problems that the American public face, I would argue that healthcare is right up there at the top of the list. And of course, yes, Republicans are going to turn it into a political football. They always have. But it doesn't change the fact that it's the right thing to do, that people in our country are suffering without healthcare in the middle of a pandemic, that people are going without access to hospital care because their hospitals are shutting down. All of these things are problems that the president has the opportunity to solve, and I believe he ought to solve them.
Abdul El-Sayed is the co-author of Medicare for All, A Citizen's Guide. He is also now a policymaker in residence at the U of M's Ford School of Public Policy. Dr. Sayed, thanks again for your time.
April, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber-Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow.